Hello all together and welcome to a new episode of Power BI or Die. This time an English episode again, because today I have one of the international experts and Microsoft MVP, NJ Park. Hello, NJ.
Hi, Arthur. It's really nice to be here. I'm really excited to talk with you today.
Yeah, so if anyone who doesn't know NJ, he has one of the biggest YouTube channels in the Power BI ecosystem. So not the top two, for example, but I think top 10, top 20, definitely. And I have seen it surpassing my channel and many others because, you were quite late in all this YouTuber and Power BI tutorial game, right?
Yeah, for sure. So I started actually posting on LinkedIn and YouTube sometime in 2022. So I was just a regular analyst doing regular analyst things. But then in July 2022, I started posting on LinkedIn. And the real reason I started doing that was because I was kind of on the bench and I was like, I'm going to do something productive when I'm on the bench and I have literally nothing to do. I'm still at work, but I need to do something. And so I was posting on LinkedIn, trying to, you know, it's like be a little bit more active there. And then I decided to make my YouTube channel. So I've had it for just over 2 years and it does okay, but I wouldn't consider myself one of the, you know, it's like top channels really just yet. I have 30,000 followers there, but I'm like, there are plenty of people who are posting things who have like millions of followers and I'm just not there yet.
Yeah, of course, they are like bigger channels, like we all know Guy in the Cube or SQL BI or Buzz Doman, but there's not that much. I think it's still like a niche, and I was never unsatisfied to have only 300 followers with my tutorials. Of course, they are in German and they're even more nichey, and 30,000 for some kind of niche focused on only one tool, it's still great, and you build it like in quite a short amount of time. And I think it's also impressive that you, I think, do not use too much of like shorts or like shiny stuff, but you have more like long, in-depth tutorials. I can really feel how you think, and yeah, just very authentic.
That is really great to hear. Like, this is actually just because I was thinking to myself that this is the kind of things that I do in regular work. You know, it's like I used to work as a technical lead, and before that, obviously a senior, you know, it's like Power BI developer, but I spent a lot of time explaining things. That was like, I feel like that was most of my work, explaining things to stakeholders, explaining things to, you know, it's like juniors or mid-level people, explaining things to, you know, PMs and stuff. And I just got really good at explaining things, and that's basically what I'm doing on YouTube. I just explain things, and I think it's really, you know, just amazing that I have, you know, it's like 30,000, because I tell you this, when I started my YouTube channel, I was like, 100 people view the video, it's a success. That was my metric. And even now, you know, it's like when sometimes my videos get like a couple thousand, you know, views, I always think to myself that if I spend 10 hours on a video and it gets watched by other people for 10 hours, that's still a success. I've still put out enough into the world where if I was teaching someone one-on-one, it's done a little better than that. So, you know, like I try to think about it this way.
Yeah, it's a good metric. And I think it's, as all community work, if you have fun doing it, if you have fun on the way, then it's not only about the outcome, I think. And sometimes you will be surprised who was watching this. So it was me. So I'm still, some months ago, I was contacted on LinkedIn about a tutorial I created 5 years ago. Like, and then it was saying, okay, there were not much views. I forgot about it, actually. And then, oh, okay, great. It helped someone. And this is nice. I think this is why we are doing this stuff.
Yeah, it's for sure. Like, did you know that I actually never studied Power BI through courses or anything? It's all been YouTube videos. I think the only courses that I've done, Like you feel it too, right? Like the only courses that I've done is SQL BI.
I mean, I'm also quiet and don't talking too loud about it because my colleagues have the certifications, but I never had the time to complete them. So, yeah, obviously I need to do it. But yeah, I also like, yeah, learned it more the autodidactic way and with YouTube tutorials. And that's why I appreciate this channel very well. It's a great way of learning.
Yeah, it's just giving back a little of something that you take. I think it's great.
Yeah, and we met each other at in real life the first time after years of like seeing stuff from each other. We met each other in Zurich in 2024 in October at the data conference. It was quite a cool event, and I had a talk, you had a talk. Yeah. Quite nice. So this is also like part of the community.
Yeah, honestly, I'm like, I gotta say, I feel like I really lucked out being part of the, you know, it's like data community, especially with Power BI, because YouTube is on social media is something that I enjoy quite a bit. I do, obviously, but just the fact that there is a, you know, community slash hobby that I do, which is, you know, my YouTube channel, which also allows me to go to different countries and see, you know, it's like people in real life and interact with, you know, it's like these people that like you and I, we've been talking online for many, many years. And it was really, honestly, I was like shocked at how tall you were, really, but it was also like, it was just really good to see so many faces.
But I'm still smaller than Nikola Ilić, so I don't know.
Hey, look, I think, you know, Nikola is probably one of the tallest in our community for sure.
Yeah, it was. It's always like you met some persons from video games or something in real life. It was for me after COVID, because I also started to engaging in this community during the lockdowns, and then it was every time when I see someone the first time, it is this is the avatar from LinkedIn, and now I see him in real life.
Yeah, I actually had a little trouble because sometimes people use images on LinkedIn, which are a couple of years old. So you're just like, I know this person, but I'm not 100% sure who this person is. And, you know, it's like, sometimes I just have to stick to someone that I know. One thing that I did when I was in Zurich was I was, you know, it's like staying next to Nikola, and I was like, Nikola, can you tell me that person's name, please? Like and you know, it's like that's how I get by. But honestly, after that, you know, small hurdle, meeting all of these people in real life is such a wonderful time.
Yeah, of course. But today we don't want only to talk about community, but also about your talk, because I was really impressed. It was quite interesting and like also kind of keynoteable, because it wasn't a classic tutorial or focused on certain features, but it was about cost of a workaround, and it was very impressive. So just tell me something, how you created this talk and why.
So thanks for asking this, and you know, it's like this is really what I wanted to talk about today. But the talk that I gave was this little idea that I had, right? One of the things that I'm trying to improve when I'm doing my YouTube channel and doing more conference sessions is I want to tell a better story. A lot of people go to conferences and they get a technical talk, which is like how to, you know, it's like upscale Azure SQL servers, you know, it's like automatically or something like that. And those are really important talks, but one thing that I think could be a little bit better was I wanted to give a lot of technical knowledge, but tell it with a story. So I was thinking of small things that I had put up on my YouTube channel and how I could, you know, integrate them into a good story. And I landed up on this, which is the overarching theme would be, what would I want to tell myself from like 3-4 years ago to watch out for? And how could I give examples of that? And cost of a workaround was actually, you know, it's like what I came up with. I do a couple of different demos talking about custom visuals, page level security, and using Power BigQuery code stored in GitHub. And even though I talk very extensively about all of those different things. I think the most important thing for me was that I wasn't really trying to explain to people, this is just how you do the workaround. I was trying to explain to people, you can do something this way, but should you do something this way? Because that was something that I really struggled with, like in my career, which is that I see a shiny new thing come out. Like when I learned about Deneb, I was like, it's like very deep into Deneb for like 6 months. And after 6 months, I really had to take a step back and think to myself, does Deneb fit this use case very well? And the truth is that there were some costs to using Deneb over just native visuals. And a lot of those kind of things I wanted to talk about in my session.
Yeah, obviously. And Deneb is a good example because when it was new, I also experimented with this and had a working student in this time, and she was digging into it. But then at some point, the customers, not all accepted this because there was less interactivity. It was not so easy to maintain as standard visuals. And then it was like, okay, so maybe this one requirement in the visual part is not that important. And many of projects shifted back to just standard visuals.
I've actually had the exact same, it's like experience. Although for me, the biggest lesson that I learned was I actually started learning Python to make Python visuals. Which was, and of course, Python visuals using, matplotlib or seaborn or something like that, those libraries, is really straightforward and quite easy to do. So I managed to do exactly what the client wanted and give it to them. But then after we, presented it to the clients, we found out that Python visuals aren't interactive. And the client wasn't very happy with that. The client was like, I do want to the visuals to all be kind of the same. I want to be able to click on any of the visuals and, explaining that to, it's like the thousands of end users that just this one doesn't work seems kind of like a hassle. Let's just go back to what we were using before. And that was like a really eye-opening time for me because I always used to, have this idea that Power BI is about making something for the sake of the report. But that was the experience that kind of opened my eyes to, we're not just building the report for the report to be good, we're building the report for end users to find value from the report.
Yeah, and we still have to keep in mind Power BI is very successful because it's a low-code platform. It's easy to adjust stuff, to create stuff. And of course, you can use it as kind of an app experience and do great stuff with workarounds. We will talk about many others later, but also with custom visuals and Deneb. And then it will be like, okay, great visual only, but not interactive. And for me, it's not the primary use case of Power BI. So the primary use case is to get easy access to data, to get hands on the data. And if you're building more and more walls and like some special workaround, then you're like separating the user from the data again and just to deliver the output. And this is
for sure. Absolutely, yeah. For sure. So in my session, I talk about, it's like three different types of workarounds: custom visualizations, page level security, and a little session about Power Query that you can run some code from outside of Power BI, which was a little bit of a rabbit hole. But let's talk a little bit more about the custom visualizations, because I think there's the most important question that you should ask when you're thinking about using workarounds is really, in my opinion, from custom visualizations, because custom visualizations for me is the definition of a workaround. It's something that's not native to Power BI. It's something that has a development cost as well as a maintenance cost. And not only that, the fact that it's just not something that's standard for Power BI developers means that if someone develops a custom visual and it's handed over to a support team and the support team doesn't know how to manage that visualization, like you said before, that's very specifically one of the costs. one of the things that I think is very important is also when you find an error at different stages of the development lifecycle, they cost different things. When you find an error in the development stage, you know, it's like there is a cost, but it's a very small cost because you're still in development mode. You just, you know, it's a change a couple of things. Perfect. When it's in UAT, the cost is actually a little bit more because, you know, it's like now you've spent more time, you know, it's like developing it and then it's gone to someone else. That there's an actual figure in terms of man hours that, you know, it's like is lost due to, you know, the error. And doesn't matter if the error is big or small, any changes, you know, it's like compound on that fact. But when an error is caught in production, then that has the biggest cost because, you know, the likelihood that it has caused a stakeholder or an end user to make a mistake is much larger. And obviously those are things you want to avoid. But those things, when we're using custom visuals, workarounds to create something new, is compounded simply because maintenance is so much harder. Of course, you know, that's not necessarily the case for everyone, right? Like if the developer who made, you know, SVGs, for example, knows how to make SVGs and they can fix it, that's not really such a big problem. But if you're working in like a gigantic corporation and you are a developer for like, you know, a consulting company, you've created this, you know, it's a really beautiful thing and no one at the company can fix it or change it, that's a problem.
Yeah, and I think for key users, if anyone of the listeners has seen some SVG code, it's quite big and it's very hard to understand when you're not into it. So some key users would say, oh, okay, this is clumsy. And they build like a certain solution right beneath it, but without the SVG. And this is how the data model gets fractured. And even if you hide the SVG in calculation groups, for example, then if people are not used to it, they will still create some more easy workarounds for the moment without. And this is for me also a good example. Yeah, that it's hard to build something that is more complex than the most unexperienced user who can change this report can use.
Of course. And, you know, that's just one aspect, right? It's also like, do you even need to use a workaround? In a lot of cases, workarounds do cause technical debts. They cause maintenance challenges. And there's even things like risk. If you're using workarounds and they are third-party apps, for example, you know, it's like third-party apps are not necessarily workarounds. They simply are just, you know, apps that someone else other than Microsoft has developed, I don't necessarily consider them workarounds. But in some cases, it is entirely possible that you are using something like Deneb, and Deneb has an upgrade, for example, or Power BI has an upgrade, and that can break a couple of things. I don't feel like that should be considered into whether or not you should be using a workaround, because anything can break from, you know, it's like an upgrade of an update of Power BI. This happens occasionally, but usually people fix it very quickly. But one of the things to consider is if you're using a custom visualization, then, and you know, it's like maybe something like an SVG or, you know, it's like Python visual, it could, you know, potentially break. It could be something that is not supported in the future. And that does carry some weight, right? Those are some things that you should have in the back of your mind. Push or streaming data sets, for example, are, I think, as of now, you can't make anymore. And that's quite a shame because push data sets, even though they are being replaced in Fabric with real-time data sets, were a really amazing way to create some kind of, you know, IoT, you know, it's like dashboards or like live stock data dashboards. And it's very easy to do, but it's not possible anymore.
You always have this risk. And I still reminds me of one project some years ago where a client decided to use a custom visual for a slicer just because it looked a little bit more pretty than the standard slicer, which is obviously not pretty, the old standard slicer. But then at some point it wasn't free anymore. And then there was like just a paywall. payable message instead of the slicer in productive reports. And this was, of course, kind of a problem you have to bear in mind that when you use them, you need to consider that something may change.
And that's absolutely true. So, you know, those are like different ways that we can kind of categorize workarounds. But one thing that I think is worth mentioning is that SVGs at the end of the day are workarounds, sure. And, you know, but SVGs, in my opinion, is one of the most well-integrated custom visuals inside of Power BI because SVGs work inside of matrices, and tables, as well as working, you know, it's like inside of list slicers, I believe list slicers or maybe tile slicers have SVGs in there. But also you can use SVGs inside of the new KPI card. And because there are a lot of different, you know, it's like visuals now that kind of support SVG rendering, it is really, really nice and easy to use, especially because you can kind of put in the Power BI variables inside of what you're actually showing in your data. And I think that's, you know, it's like really great. A lot of the different things that we use inside of Power BI, a lot of the different techniques for, you know, custom visualizations don't have this level of integration. Python visuals, for example, just have, you know, it's like the one Python visual and, you know, it's like it doesn't integrate so well inside of the Power BI service. Deneb works really well. And, you know, my problems with Deneb is really just about the fact that the code, even as a former software developer, is still a little hard for me to, you know, like go through. It really feels very, you know, like a different skill set than for most Power BI developers.
Yeah, there's people who think it's easier to maintain than workarounds on standard visuals or like someone say MacGyvering the standard visuals, but it depends. I think for most business users, Deneb is still such a learning curve that they will not want to take without the urgency.
For sure. I mean, at the same time, it's also like, how do you say, it's also slightly different, in my opinion, from how developers work when they're in-house versus, you know, it's like consulting, so out of the house, which is like, if you're in-house and you're going to make sure that you're staying, you know, it's like there for, you know, it's like a while, and you're like the one Power BI developer on like a team, which, let's be honest, is most people who work with Power BI. Like, they're just the one Power BI developer building the reports for the one team. Then, in my opinion, you gotta use whatever it takes to, you know, to get the results that you need. And sometimes those are custom visualizations and things like that. And I don't think that people should shy away from them, especially when they're learning. But I also feel like you have to kind of use them. You have to experience them at least a couple times for you to be able to make that decision. You know, don't just listen to me because I have a YouTube channel. try to, you know, it's like at least test things out yourself. I think it's a really important part of growth. And I also think it's a really important part of becoming a better Power BI developer is that you allow yourself to fail occasionally, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's important. And I think we had like custom visuals and SVGs, and this is something like a technical debt or workaround that you can pay. But you also talked about some stuff which is really edgy, like running Power Query code from GitHub. This was a technical debt that you could not pay, or you considered that you shouldn't pay it because, yeah, you can use this web connector in very special ways and not everything works.
For sure. So let me explain that one a little more clearly, which is that one of the things that I was trying earlier this year, so sometime in January 2024, was I was trying to see if... Okay, so the actual way that the story started was that I was on the Power BI subreddit, and I was looking through a couple of different, you know, it's like posts there, and I saw one comment, and that comment was saying that there's this one function inside of Power Query. It's called expression.evaluate. And inside of Power Query, it's so strong that if you have Power Query code, which is not inside of Power BI, but inside of your documents folder or something, inside of your local machine, your computer, it can run that code by finding that file, opening it, and taking that code out and just running it. So that was pretty amazing, because if you have that code on SharePoint or OneDrive or something, that could potentially go to a lot of different Power BI files at the same time, kind of enabling DevOps or data ops on Power Query, which would be pretty amazing. However, the problem was, of course, that, you know, if you're just using your local machine, then that limits, you know, it's like very much what you can do. So one of the things that I was testing was maybe we can use some specific Power Query functions like web connector, and maybe that could take code from an online repository like Azure DevOps or GitHub repos and run that code from there. This was like kind of a 2-week exercise where I was trying a bunch of different things, and we ran into a lot of different problems, like the fact that the Power BI desktop and the Power BI service have access to different functions. And because there's a difference between what functions exist in the service and the desktop, you can't necessarily use some specific keywords like the hashtag shared keyword, which is what the expression.evaluate function uses. But then again, it was also one of the things was, if you're trying to run Power Query code from a GitHub repo, then access and, you know, security becomes the biggest issue, because if you have some code that's retrieving some data for example, from a SQL table, then that code, then that security has to be aligned properly inside of Power BI. And because it could dynamically change into, you know, to point from one table to another, Power BI and Microsoft just does not allow that from, you know, a security standpoint. And that kind of took away the idea of being able to make data ops using this specific method. There is still a way to use this method to create Power Query functions that can be reused across, you know, it's like a lot of different, you know, people. But it's also like, at the end of the day, Power BI, you know, it's like report format will probably allow us to have this kind of, you know, GitHub repo related, you know, it's like DevOps. It is not the best way that, you know, it's like we can actually do this in the first place. And, you know, we have things like data flows or semantic models and live connected, you know, reports that can, you know, to do kind of what I was trying to achieve, get this Power Query, you know, it's like code that goes into lots of different reports, and you can achieve something similar, you know, in different ways. But I was really hoping that this would work. And the cost of this workaround was that it doesn't work, you can't actually make the specific use case work. And one of the reasons I wanted to, you know, to like talk about this specific experience was that this was the one of the biggest, I don't want to say time wasters, because I don't feel like it was. I learned so much about, you know, it's like Power Query and the way that it runs inside of the service and the desktop. But at the end of the day, I spent a large portion of time trying to make this work, even though if it was my own time. One of the things that I feel like as a younger developer, I really should have known when to kind of stop. Like, I think maybe it's just a personality thing, but I really tried to take custom visuals or any kind of custom workarounds and really make it work. And it's much more important to be able to say, this isn't working and I shouldn't spend more time prioritizing trying to make it work.
Yeah, I think that this would never work in a real paid project, right? Because they are at least, okay, you have the idea of making Power Query flexible, but at some point they will say, hey, come on, we can just copy paste something from a Git repo. It's much faster. And of course, it's not like the perfect technical construction, but it works, and you save some weeks because of it. But Yeah, I think it's always with the things, if it's fun to discover something, then you forget. Sometimes you forget about the business value because it's fun, right? And it was fun for you, and also some things to just work with the tool. I think that's why we became like self-employed in Power BI, because we have fun with this stuff. But you should not forget, you can have the fun, but in real projects, you also have to consider what is the efficient way and what is like the sellable way of work with some requirements.
For sure. I think that, one of the things that not a lot of people are talking about, especially on, conference sessions, is like the basic things, like how to gather requirements properly, how to focus on delivering business value. And I feel like everyone that I meet has a slightly different way of doing it. And I'm like, maybe the next session that I make will be more about this, like more of the business side of things. I feel like most people kind of get it. Most people know how to do it because they have to do it because it's part of their daily work. But a lot of people, it's like especially juniors that, it's like I talk to have trouble dealing with two or three main things. First is gathering requirements in general. Like how do you even talk to stakeholders? Like a lot of people early on in the career just don't have guidance on that. Then it's like, how do you take requirements and start building the blocks of, it's like a report? Like, how do you separate specific requirements? And of course, if you don't know anything about user stories or user, it's like groups or personas or stuff like that, then, it is a little bit difficult to just talk to someone and say, this is the report that I'm going to give you. Do you like it? Should we change something? To get that kind of feedback. But I think the third thing, the most important thing that a lot of Power BI developers don't really get anymore, or not that that's too much to say. It's more like that junior Power BI developers sometimes struggle with, is how do you deal with changing requirements? Because in our, it's like world, in our data world, if you're like me and you worked a lot with like smaller departments, smaller businesses, small teams, people really are, it's like less structured, and they go very much into thinking, we can change this, we can change that, and of course we will, but data models and visualizations are still relatively strict, and trying to add new requirements is hard. Dealing with that is very hard, in my opinion.
Yeah, and this is we both learned through years, but I'm also not anymore proud of the things I built 6 or 7 years ago. But at this time, they helped people, and about the creation and stakeholder management, I think it's more and more the successful projects are the one where you communicate a lot. Like in every second, in every step, you talk with the stakeholders and show your report and say, okay, could we make this better or not? I've never seen successful BI projects where all the requirements were predefined right in the beginning.
I feel like that's also just how some consulting, it's like companies work. Of course, people who work at consulting companies know this very well. Like there's usually a work statement or something like that with, it's like predefined requirements, what's going to be delivered and, things like that. And that's really a difficult thing, especially for Power BI developers, where whoever wrote that, it's like those predefined requirements usually aren't the actual end users, and the end users have a different idea of what will bring them value to their process. And, just aligning those things can be, can be a full-time job, probably.
Yeah. And it's more hard to talk to all the stakeholders than just to recreate some Excel or PDF in Power BI.
For sure. Recreating an Excel or PDF in Power BI is the easy part of the process.
Yeah. And I think now, like with a little bit of clock watching, and the episode was quite interesting. And now when we come to an end, of course, you as a visualization expert and kind of a person who likes to investigate all the features of Power BI, then I can bring my standard question back. So what's your most wished update that you most wanted update that you want to have in Power BI in the next months?
So I will very happily say this. One of the things that is planned for updates, and if you don't know about this, you know, it's like, please check out the, you know, Power BI Core Visuals vision board. Mm-hmm. Like the Power BI Core Visuals team has released a really amazing, you know, it's like tool to see what they have planned. You know, it's like in terms of native visualization releases. But one of the things that I personally really, really want to have is conditional formatting in every place possible. So what I mean by that is you usually have some options for conditional formatting, but in some visuals, you know, you're not able to change the colors, like line charts, bar charts, for example, when you have different conditions on the actual bars. So like, let's say you're looking at regions, you can't set the colors of specific regions with a conditional formatting in some charts. For specific regions, for example, you might have to set the colors manually, you know, it's like in some places. And that, in my opinion, is okay a couple of years ago, but now it's, you know, it's like time for everything to be conditionally formatted. I like to do a lot of conditional formatting with DAX measures. And I feel like if conditional formatting is everywhere, then something like a, you know, it's like drill down or, you know, it's like deep dive can really be done all inside drill through pages. But as of right now, it can't. Like sometimes you want to drill through to some specific pages and you have some kind of color coding. And just because of the color coding, you have to make four different pages instead of one. I'm actually thinking of some very specific use cases here. You know, it's like in my own work, but my answer is conditional formatting in every place possible. Even something like being able to change the chart size would be amazing, especially if you have a situation where you're showing two visuals or maybe three visuals, depending on a role level security. So let's say one person, a manager, sees three KPIs, but you know, someone who's not a manager is only supposed to see two. If you're able to change the chart size as well based around that, that would be big, and we could do a lot of things with that. But at the same time, I know that the way that Power BI native visuals work is that there is a dedicated hierarchy. And what I mean by that is that there are dependencies. So if a specific feature that I want needs, you know, I want them to start building on it, it might be that there are some other features that need to be built first before they'll start working on that. And, you know, that's something that has been mapped out by the Power BI Core Visuals team. So when will we see conditional formatting? I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, but we can check out the vision board. So yeah, we will link it in the show notes as well as the YouTube channel of Inge Park, of course, Power BI Park, and also his LinkedIn profile. So everyone who's not following you right now should follow you now for more tutorials and more great considerations about workarounds and cool visual stuff. And from my side, I can just thank you for being here, Inge, and see you again at one of the next events or streams.
Hopefully. For sure, Arthur. Thank you so much for inviting me. Are you by any chance going to either Oslo or Prague? Prague's in this week, and Oslo is in February.
I cannot make it. February maybe, but in February, I will already be at the SQL conference in Hanau.
Oh, and, yeah.
I think I will definitely take this one, and I'm not sure if I can afford one event more in February. And there's, I will also have my own event in March, and then there is also the big events. I will not be there, I think, in the US. But of course, February, March are full of events. And yeah, so you will be in Oslo, I think.
Yes.
And, anyone who's listening to this, that will be released before February. So if you want to see NGPark live, just go to Oslo to February.
Or come to Wrocław SQL Day in May, because that is, because I will for sure be there, because that's in my city.
This is something I can really consider, because May is not that packed as March or February. Thanks for this.
For sure, Arthur. So thanks again.
Yeah. See you.